This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. And I'm floating in a most peculiar way. And the stars look very different today.
Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 16 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us about today's topic.
Well, Space Talks is already deep into Season 3, and I thought we couldn't delay this topic any longer, actually. And the topic in question, I suppose, it's one that isn't easily answered unless you look way beyond our own planet. And that question is, what is the origin of life? And Steve, we've only got 30 minutes, so we better knock off our updates quickly. What have you got for us?
Well, I'm not sure we're going to be all that pressed for time, Tim, because I've read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe by Douglas Adams, and I've got the answer right here. Let's have a listen.
The answer to the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything, 42.
And now for my update today, which once again brings into focus the importance of Penticton's CHIME radio astronomy array with another breakthrough discovery. The most recent significant detection of a fast radio burst, or FRB, was announced on February 12th this year. This is the first FRB which repeats with a predictable frequency, with this one exhibiting a 16.3-day cycle, during which it's active for approximately 4 days and then silent for 12 days. This fast radio burst comes from a spiral galaxy 457 million light years distant in a star-forming region. Now, the significance of this is it suggests a possible connection of FRBs to a highly magnetized neutron star, or magnetar, and we'll be talking about those later on. And this could be from a precessing neutron star where the variability of its radio outbursts comes from its wobbling motion. CHIME's detection of this particular FRB rules out catastrophic one-time events like neutron star mergers as the sole cause of them. So, a continued hooray for BC's CHIME and its Canadian scientists. And how about you, Tim? What's your update this episode?
Well, I've got one. It's about a news item I read about Vera Rubin. She was an American scientist famous for her research into dark matter. Now, she got her start in the 1960s, but she passed away in 2016. Ms. Rubin earned the National Medal of Science and had an observatory built and funded by the United States named after her in 2016. That observatory, actually, it's located in Chile. So far, so good. But in February, the observatory was in the news for some very not scientific reasons. On the federal website for the observatory, the page that honors Ms. Rubin was edited to remove content that reflected her tireless efforts to promote women in their pursuit of careers in science. And it seems that mention of Ms. Rubin's efforts ran afoul of President Trump's views on diversity, equity, and inclusion. So I'm going to read the paragraph that was deleted. And I guess we can let listeners decide just how offensive this sounds to them. Here we go. Science is still a male-dominated field, but Rubin Observatory is working to increase participation from women and other people who have historically been excluded from science. Rubin Observatory welcomes everyone who wants to contribute to science and takes steps to lower or eliminate barriers that exclude those with less privilege.
Well, we should note that the suppression of historical facts and the rewriting of history is not only thematic to George Orwell's dystopian 1984 novel, it's currently ringing the alarm bell for the current state of democracy south of the border. We shouldn't stray from Space Talk's focus, which is science, not politics, though admittedly there's always been a fine line separating the two. Just ask a certain Mr. Galileo. Okay, let's get to today's topic, the origins of life. And it's fair to say that there have been three distinct branches to this debate. The oldest is that life was created by the Creator, and that forms the basis of all faith-based religions. The other two branches regarding the origin of life are science-based, and these are known as abiogenesis and panspermia. Abiogenesis means the evolution of life came from inorganic or inanimate substances combining to form single cells of some sort. Panspermia is the theory that life on Earth originated from microorganisms or chemical precursors of life arriving from outer space. And we're going to go deeper into both of these science-based theories. But Tim, what's got your attention?
Well, a few years ago, NASA sent a spacecraft to visit the asteroid Bennu. And incredibly, at least incredible to me, they scooped up some rocks from the asteroid and returned them and dropped them back off at Earth. Now, the mission started in 2016. It took them 7 years to fly 3 billion kilometers to reach the asteroid. And imagine this, Steve, it's only 500 meters in diameter. Canada supplied some of the onboard technology for this mission, and consequently, Canadian scientists received about 4% of the bounty of rocks that had been returned from this remarkable source. Now, I want to play a clip from a fairly recent news report that aired on CBC's The National. There's a lot to unpack from this research, but let's just hear the CBC report from The National that aired in January of this year. And we're going to be hearing the reporter talk to Kim Tate. She's a curator of mineralogy at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto, and also Chris Hurd, who is a professor of earth and atmospheric sciences from the University of Calgary.
Leave it to NASA to get people excited about a bunch of rocks, but these are no ordinary ones. They came from here, the small asteroid Bennu. And the mission to go there years ago wasn't just for observation, but extraction. Touching down to flick up samples and bringing them back to Earth. Now, the patience of mineralogists like Kim Tate have uncovered just what's in those rocks.
There is a lot of organics, which we expected, but these organics were actually forming in a very salty, briny water, which we didn't expect at all.
In other words, evidence that Bennu broke off from an ancient watery world as it flew around the chaos of the early solar system. The new research also found a complex soup of compounds, including the building blocks of the stuff we're made of, proteins, RNA, and DNA.
And if those were being delivered to the early Earth, that might have had an influence then on what took hold on the Earth.
Similar compounds have been found in meteorites that landed on Earth, but the key difference is that the Bennu samples are pristine, uncontaminated by entering Earth's atmosphere.
This is the justification, effectively, for bringing samples back by a spacecraft.
And since Canada helped with onboard instruments, samples of Bennu will come here, helping scientists like Tate dig deeper.
For researchers like myself across Canada to be able to study them, and not only us, but the next generation of scientists that are out there as well.
The mention of RNA and DNA found on those rock samples is certainly a big headliner to me. But I hasten to lack any degrees in biology, notwithstanding one stellar exam result in grade 10 botany, and so much for any personal credo in that area, Tim. However, there is also the mention of finding both left and right-sided DNA symmetry. Now, I'm going to need to do some serious research on that one, Tim, as this molecular detail is not only fascinating, it has tremendous implications. That's in the future. And we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Indeed we are. I didn't want to bury the lead, as journalists like to say. So let's get back to the first of those theses, abiogenesis. Can we make the case that life can start from inorganic material? In the 1920s, there were, in fact, two scientists working independently, by the way, both put forward the idea that, given the right atmospheric conditions and a primordial soup with just the right broth, well, it was possible for the spontaneous formation of organic molecules. Two other scientists, Drs. Stanley Miller and Harold Urey, in 1952, they conducted experiments that created long-chain amino acids, which are building blocks for proteins. And they did this by taking simple molecules and exposing them to gases like methane, ammonia, and water, Throw in some electrical discharges to simulate lightning, and voila!
Initially, they were celebrated for their work. But a few years later, people began to question the composition of the gases used in their experiments, arguing that Earth's early atmosphere was richer in carbon dioxide than their methane, thus invalidating some of their findings.
That's right. Okay, so one theory is launched and lands, not a crash landing, but a rough landing. And that was back in 1952. So since that time, and right up to the present, there have been many more experiments and many more discoveries, and I think we should touch on some of the highlights. And that's all there'll be. There's more than we could get to today. So one of the more interesting ones involved deep-sea hydrothermal vents, where hot, mineral-rich water spews from the Earth's crust. And one of the arguments in favor of this theory, for the origin of life, is the very strange creatures that actually live and prosper in these vents. And they have an amazing name. They are known as extremophiles. There's actually a surprising spectrum of life in these vents, including some that can live in places where the temperature exceeds 121°C, which just happens to be the temperature used for sterilizing medical equipment. So the point being that we are learning that life can survive in incredibly harsh environments, and some of these source energy in very different ways than we see here above ground.
Okay, and here's another thesis, which is the so-called clay hypothesis. This proposes that complex organic molecules could have formed on the surfaces of clay minerals, which are known to be able to absorb and concentrate organic molecules. And that's a good starting point for listener personal research.
The next one I'm going to mention is this. It's got a funny name. It's known as the RNA world hypothesis. Scientists can now create self-replicating RNA molecules in the lab, and other research has shown that simple RNA-like molecules form spontaneously from prebiotic conditions. And we can actually go on. There are other fascinating avenues of exploration, but there is an important bottom line. We cannot create life from inorganic material yet.
And right you are, Tim. And at this juncture, we've got a couple of key players to introduce to this discussion. And first up, Charles Darwin. In 1859, Darwin published his shattering book, The Origin of Species, which was not about how the first species came into being, but how the abundant life on our planet evolved. And prior to Darwin's publication, the prevalent view was of fixed species. That is, you've got your bears, your dogs, your wombats, your human beings, and so on down the line. Darwin argued that variations within any one species were the result of the natural selection, and over time, new species evolved. Sure, it was slow, but so was history, which meant that there was plenty of time for the evolutionary process to build the tree of life as we know it today.
So every once in a while, scientists come along and they make these outrageous assertions, you know, like, the Earth is round, or, you know what, the Earth circles the sun, and human beings evolving from other species that are now lost in time.
Well, Darwin certainly fits into that mold, and here's a surprising little nugget. It's been 100 years since the famous monkey trial, where a teacher, John Scopes, was charged with teaching evolution in an American classroom in contradiction to the Butler Act in Tennessee. What many people might not know is that Scopes, the teacher, was actually convicted, but fortunately set free on a technicality.
Darwin never did postulate as to how the first species arrived on the scene, but that aside, he did shatter thinking about how life had evolved from a common thread. And while scientists have not been able to create life in the lab, so to speak, there is now genome testing that clearly confirms Darwin's theory that life on Earth has a shared history. I'm going to cite just a simple one example here. Chimpanzees share 98.7% of their DNA with humans.
That explains some of the parties I've attended. Well, let's just do a little quick recap here, Tim. Our focus today is with regard to the origin of life and Darwin's theory of evolution. And let's not forget that theory in scientific literature is a rigorous term. His theory of evolution proves the common thread of life on Earth And that certainly can point to the validity of the abiogenesis theory that life started in some sort of primordial soup from inorganic material. There is evidence of abiogenesis, but no direct proof.
The competing thesis for the origin of life is called panspermia. Now let's start with a definition. Panspermia is the theory that life on Earth originated from microorganisms or chemical precursors of life present in outer space and able to initiate life on reaching a suitable environment. Strangely enough, the idea was kickstarted in the 1960s by a scientist we'll be discussing in a minute or two. But the roots of panspermia date back a long, long way. And I'm going to pick up that story by mentioning another great scientist, Lord William Thomson Kelvin, the scientist who brought us the temperature scale that bears his name and the one that starts at absolute zero. In 1871, he was speaking to the British Association for the Advancement of Science, and he proposed the idea that just as seeds can be transferred through the air by winds, so can life be brought to Earth by the infall of a life-bearing meteorite. And he went on to assert that life can only come from life. Now, I just have to insert a sidebar here, Steve. The notion that there is life elsewhere in the universe really hasn't been that popular until recent times. Even in the 1950s and 60s, a majority of people would brush aside any suggestion of the sort that there was life elsewhere in the universe. And Kelvin, his remarks date back to 1870, but the views on the likelihood of life elsewhere in the galaxy did start to change in the 1960s. And one reason for that was this amazing scientist, Fred Hoyle.
And you know, amazing is an apt descriptor for this man. He's the contrarian physicist and astronomer from England, famous for his theories regarding stellar nucleosynthesis. And that's an elaborate way of saying that the immense pressures and forces in dying stars create elements heavier than hydrogen and helium. And we're talking about, in sequential order, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, and all the way up. Now, this came about, interestingly enough, after he attended a series of nuclear lectures at McGill University during World War II. Learning of the implosion process and atomic bombs led to his 1946 paper on stellar nucleosynthesis. Subsequent papers in 1954 and 1957 cemented his place as a leading scientist of that era.
And who hasn't heard the expression, "We are all stardust"? That is very much the product of Hoyle's work on the creation of other elements. So we know that Hoyle has some serious chops, as in he was a very well-established scientist. So why is there all this talk about him being such a contrarian?
Well, in 1949, Hoyle participated in a BBC show called Third Program. That was said to be the first time anyone had used the term Big Bang to describe what has become the prevailing cosmological model of the universe's origin, that is, the cosmos coming into existence from a single source and expanding. The interesting thing is, Hoyle was actually being derisive when he coined the Big Bang term. He had no time for the theory, as it suggested time was begun by a creator, and he was a devout atheist. He might have named it, but he wasn't buying it. Instead, he believed in his own steady state theory.
Okay, that must have been weird. He likely imagined then that his dismissive term, Big Bang Theory, would help, well, diminish the theory, and that just didn't happen. But let's move along to another one of his very disruptive beliefs. Abiogenesis was in his sights. One way of summing up his doubts would be that given the pace of change, using natural selection as the motor of change, this wasn't the time available for all the change that we have seen in the evolution that's taken place. Along with his colleague Chandra Wickramasinghe, they proposed that the first life on Earth began in space, spreading through the universe via panspermia, and that evolution of life on Earth was then subject to a steady influx of viruses arriving via comets.
But let's hear Sir Fred Hoyle speak for himself. We found a wonderful clip known as Hoyle's Junkyard Tornado, where he sums up his critique of Darwin's abiogenesis theory, and he does so in just over 2 minutes.
Hi, I'm Fred Hoyle. Junkyard contains all the bits and pieces of a Boeing 747, dismembered and in disarray. A whirlwind happens to blow through the yard. What is the chance that after its passage a fully assembled 747, ready to fly, will be found standing there? So small as to be negligible, even if a tornado were to blow through enough junkyards to fill the whole universe. How, for instance, would the enzyme clump distinguish an exceedingly infrequent useful enzyme from the overwhelming majority of useless chains of amino acids? The one potential enzyme would be so infrequent that the aggregate might have to encounter 50 quintillion, that is 50 to the power of 18 useless chains before meeting a suitable one. In short, there is not a shred of objective evidence to support the hypothesis that life began in an organic soup here on the Earth. So why do biologists indulge in unsubstantiated fantasies in order to deny what is so patently obvious, that the 200,000 amino acid chains, and hence life, did not appear by chance? The answer lies in a theory developed over a century ago, which sought to explain the development of life as an inevitable product of the purely local natural processes. Its author, Charles Darwin, hesitated to challenge the Church's doctrine on the creation. However, he privately suggested that life itself may have been produced in some warm little pond, and to this day his followers have sought to explain the origin of terrestrial life in terms of a process of chemical evolution from the primordial soup. But, as we have seen, this simply does not fit the facts. Given the nature of forces in a tornado, it is not only statistically improbable to the enormous extreme for a tornado to assemble a 747 from a junkyard full of parts, it is truly impossible, because while it is hypothetically possible to bring a pair of parts into the correct alignment through the wild winds of a tornado, the same forces would just as quickly separate them again. Not only that, but tornado winds will never exert the kind of forces necessary to tighten a screw or fasten a rivet. Analogous difficulties can easily be seen in any attempt to form useful proteins necessary for cell survival in even the most basic cells.
So interestingly, Hoyle's colleague reflected in 2003 that, quote, in the highly polarized polemic between Darwinism and creationism, our position is unique. Although we don't align ourselves with either side, both sides treat us as opponents.
Hoyle had enough notoriety at this time that he did nudge a great many people into thinking that perhaps life not only existed on other planets, but perhaps life on Earth had been shaped in some fashion by cosmic dust.
The thing is that the critics had the same argument against Hoyle as they had against Lord Kelvin some 100 years prior. They made the fairly reasonable assertion that nothing alive could possibly survive entry into the Earth's atmosphere, or for that matter, stay alive on a comet for some what unimaginable number of years. Remember, we said that Hoyle's assault on abiogenesis happened in the 60s, and of course, the most well-known astronomical event of that decade, well, that would happen to be the arrival of humans on the surface of the moon. But also in 1969 was the landing in Australia of a carbon-rich meteor known as the Murchison meteor. And Steve, how did that meteor matter in the great scheme of things?
Well, it mattered a great deal, actually. The name of the meteor, first of all, came from the place it impacted, and that is Murchison, Australia, on September 28, 1969. It's become one of the most studied meteorites for good reason, as it hosts a rich array of organic compounds, including amino acids, which are the building blocks for life. Some of the over 100 amino acids found in it can be found also on Earth, suggesting an extraterrestrial origin for organic chemistry. Murchison was also extremely old, about 7 billion years old, far older than our own sun. And the implication is that complex organic molecules found on the meteor are insights into some very early cosmic chemistry. And finally, and most importantly, the Murchison meteor supports both panspermia and abiogenetic theories that prebiotic chemistry can occur in space, and that early Earth may have been seeded with life's building blocks.
Is it time for a Zen-like moment, Steve? sort of a sharp contrast to the boxing match metaphor we used when discussing quasars?
Oh, go right ahead.
Okay, well, Hoyle's most significant contribution to our understanding of life dates back to the 1940s, when he made the case that the elements that make up, well, our human bodies, are nearly entirely comprised of stardust, the remnants of the death of stars. And of course, that was a byproduct of his research on stellar nucleosynthesis. There are about 60 elements found in the human body, and 24 are essential for life, and aside from a couple, the rest all come from stellar nucleosynthesis. And if those elements largely come from outer space, well, it now seems there's a strong case that life on Earth may also derive from deposits from deep space. Not only is there life elsewhere in our universe, but it is likely that life beyond Earth influenced the development of life on Earth. Well, you know, maybe today we can just look a little higher up into space and say the materials that went into the making of our bodies came from outer space, and even the precursors to the first creation of life on Earth may also have been seeded from outer space.
And that brings us back to the news of the day, Tim, which is the initial findings from the rock samples brought back from the asteroid Bennu. And while that's not a Zen moment, it certainly is special. And as always, we love to mention Canadian content on Space Talks, and let's just say it again. Canada made a significant contribution to the NASA mission to send a spacecraft to Bennu and bring back those materials, and now scientists in Calgary and Toronto have published findings which detail the building blocks of life that were found on the asteroid. They found 5 nucleobases: adenine, guanine, cytosine, thymine, and uracil, which are the fundamental genetic components of DNA and RNA. All 5 of these were found on the rock samples. Though not fully formed as RNA and DNA, these nucleobases certainly lend credence to the building blocks of life on Earth arriving from space. In summation, abiogenesis is logically the prevalent choice for the origin of life in the cosmos, as panspermia doesn't really address how life first began. Be that as it may, from a cosmological stance, how life began on Earth remains a viable toss-up between abiogenesis and panspermia.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of Space Talk. So this is Tim Woods.
And Stephen Lowry here in Salmon Arms saying so long, and we'll see you next time on
Space Talks.
Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride?